On May 24th, 1990, two Earth First organizers, Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney, were injured, Judy very seriously, when a bomb exploded in Barry's car. Within hours, they were arrested for possession of explosives, even though it was obviously an assassination attempt. Judy was in intensive care after major surgery at the time of her arrest. No charges were ever filed and no real investigation was ever done. The FBI and Oakland police still claim Barry and Cherney are the main suspects to this day. In 1991, Barry filed a civil lawsuit along with Cherney for violations of their First and Fourth Amendment rights. After 12 years, the case finally made it to court. After slogging through every roadblock the FBI and Oakland police could come up with to keep it out of court, after a six-week trial and 3 weeks of jury deliberations, the jury found the FBI and Oakland Police Department liable for $4.4 million in damages. Today, we're honored to have one of the jurors here on KMUD, Daryl's hometown radio station, the station he called from jail after the bombing when he was given one collect call to make. And as we said, it can take a village to mount a lawsuit, so we are pleased to have you visit one of the villages in the community that has generated the forest protection movement of the North Coast. Welcome to Women on Wednesday, Mary Nunn.
Thank you.
And first, I'd like to thank you for being part of the solution to an extremely long-standing injustice and for making all the years of work and community fundraising worthwhile and for finally exonerating Judy and Daryl. And also, most importantly, for taking a courageous step to protect the rights of everyone to speak out and to organize for social change. Thank you very much. And so speaking of speaking out, why are you speaking up? You know, I've noticed like a major silence on the part of other jurors. What moves you to speak about what happened?
Well, I believe that what I played witness to in those 3 months was so utterly wrong, and I was so moved by it that how could you not speak out? I thought it was pretty devastating what took place, and I think the more you speak out, the more you put it out in the forefront, the least likely it could replay itself again. Let's hope as such. I know it does every day, but I think the more you put it out there, the more people hear about it, it may make them think twice before they act in this manner again.
And what made the biggest impression on you during the trial, both on the plaintiff's and the defendant's side? And for people who haven't followed this case closely, in this case, the defendants are actually the FBI and the police, not us, which is a real turnaround.
Well, I guess what made the biggest impression upon me was the lying and the disregard. They're coming to court thinking that just because they have this title, that was presence enough, that they didn't have to account for their actions of that time, that we would just buy into whatever they had to say simply because of who they were. And they're so wrong. You do have to give account for your actions. You don't get to just flow as you wish. So I would say that the blatant lying, the blatant disregard, the obvious evidence in the case, the lies in the search warrant, the immediate response to arrest, the way they were on scene so fast, all these different elements was just all too much to comprehend. So that was the biggest downfall as far as absorbing the FBI. And as far as the Earth First people, you could tell right away from their demeanor that the way they were being described just didn't fit. Something was grossly wrong with the picture they were projecting. Here were these people coming to court every day for 3 months, giving up their money, their life, you name it. I mean, the dedication was phenomenal. You don't see that every day. And they had a aura about them in the room. It was very, very, I don't know, very earthy, very loving, very nurturing. And it just, it didn't sit well, you know. And even with that, I mean, you can't really even go on that. It was really the facts of the case. But the type of people these FBI were prescribing them to be just didn't go over at all.
Right. It all added up to one kind of verdict, obviously. And like you were saying, the important thing was the facts in the case, which
that's what it came down to. Yeah.
There were plenty of that.
Yeah.
Was there a particular moment during the trial when you realized that that the FBI and police defendants were the dishonest people and that Judy and Daryl were really the good guys? Because I know you didn't have any preconceived notion when you got on the jury.
Well, actually, you know, that's not true. I don't know if anyone knows this. I took a 180-degree turn in that courthouse. So that's not true. I kind of went in there. See, you have to understand.
You went in there thinking.
Well, you have to understand the era that I'm from. I'm not real well versed with environmental groups. I don't know a lot about it. I'm from a real kind of inner city, so I'm far removed from those type of aspects. And when I was subjected to all that was taking place in the courtroom, I was more to think. The only environmentalists I had ever seen was people for the right, you know, in front of abortion clinics and hearing of doctors getting killed and then maybe some backlash back and forth. So I thought whatever was happening, you know, maybe the people involved had brought on their own plight or something, and maybe the cops were, whatever this all was, were kind of just trying to do whatever they could to settle it out. So it was actually, if you really want to know the truth about it, more partial towards them. Because I was thinking.
More partial towards the FBI. And
because I just thought, well, you know, this is all I ever knew. I knew nothing of this world, nothing of this movement, nothing. But then when it started to come out, you know, and that was only in the opening statements, mind you. This was before the facts and the setup of the flow of things, and they started telling the story of the events. This was only in the open presentation. Yeah. So I had heard nothing, but this is like, I'm sure it's nothing too severe, you know. But then when it all started to flow, I was like, oh, no, this can't be.
So was there a particular moment where you went, whoa, like had an epiphany, or was it the overall presentation?
I'd have to say everybody contributed. It wasn't just one person. I think each agent, when they took the stand and gave their address to their actions, was blatant something was wrong. I mean, it was wrong. I mean, one was blaming the other. One was diverting from the other. Nobody would claim anything or stand up. And it was amazing to me that one guy's statement through the whole thing was, I don't recall, I don't recall. I mean, how does that excuse you in life?
You don't recollect.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't excuse you in life. It doesn't excuse me in my life in anything.
Right.
I can't get away with that in anything, not with my husband, not with my job. I have to give rhyme or reason for my actions. It's just not that simple. In the littlest things to the biggest things, there has to be reason. And so that didn't fly at all. That was just, wow, how do they get away with that type of thing? I was blown away by that.
You know, I was one of the many people from Southern Humboldt and also many people from Mendocino County who attended the trial in support of the issues being fought for. And, you know, please tell us, as a juror, did it matter that people were there in the courtroom every day? And did how they look matter? Did the demeanor of the audience matter? How did that, you know, play into the jury's... I mean, sometimes you thought, oh, the jury isn't paying any attention to us. We're paying attention to them, but...
Actually, it made a big difference to me. I guess I can primarily speak for me, because I don't like to speak for other people, but, I mean... to me, it made a big difference, because that showed dedication, it showed loyalty, it showed that this was something worthwhile and worth believing. This wasn't just to make a point. I mean, people don't give all that up to make a point. I mean, this was real, and that's why they had all those people behind them supporting them. And I don't know anyone in the world that has that. I've never seen that kind of support before, mind you. And I've belonged to big organizations before, but they've never come down like that ever once. And I'm talking churches and everything else. I've never seen it. For instance, when my mother passed away when I was a kid, she belonged to this Catholic church for many, many, many years. Us kids were dragged to it, you know, 3 days a week. And at her funeral, there were 5 people in attendance. And it was a congregation of 300 plus. Where were they at? I don't know. And of course, I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore as a result of that, because that was no family to me. You see, and so to see that was beautiful. You know, it meant the world to me. It meant the world to me. It made all the difference to see your faces there every day. And I was concerned for all of you. I didn't want you to be despaired, but, you know, of course we couldn't let on in that respect. But I was very concerned about all of you, because I could see the dedication and the loyalty. And I know it looked menacing sometimes, because, you know, who we were up against, you know, sometimes it says it all in most cases, you know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think were the most effective arguments made by the plaintiffs and also by the defense? And for listeners not as familiar with this case, remember that the FBI and Oakland Police are the defendants. It took me a while to wrap my mind around that. We're so used to being on the defense. And actually, they tried to definitely make it out like Judy and Daryl were the guilty ones throughout the case. So it was, you know, quite a game.
Well, you know, unfortunately for me, it's not that hard of a leap. You know, I see police coming on scene and being unjust mm-hmm. many different ways, many times over. Yeah. It's unfortunate, but it's the way that it is. Mm-hmm. But to get back to the subject, one exchange was with Senna.
Senna was
He was FBI agents. Yes, yeah. He was the guy who actually came to the hospital and was interviewing Daryl, and then later escorted him to the police department. How he got there so fast and where he came from, I don't know, but he was there. Typically, FBI don't get involved till the next day or something, but they were on scene, like, within minutes. I mean, and they were formatting everything, influencing everyone. But getting back to the question at hand, when Senna was being questioned, that man took his glasses off so many times from irritation. I mean, he was literally, like, slamming them down to the point when we went back in the deliberation room, and it was odd, you know. I was like, I think, you know, they should have broke. You know, because he was very defensive. He was very agitated at the questions. He didn't like the fact that someone was trying to request him to answer them. He didn't like that at all. It was like he was bigger than that, and he was offended by it. And, you know, it was too bad. And he never really did address the questions. He kept skating them. He never gave any account for anything that he did. He just, you know, diverted or said he wasn't interested. He didn't care then. He didn't care now. And he you know, I don't know.
So he felt he was above or beyond the
law.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. And but you could see in his body language the arrogance and the agitated way that he was mm-hmm. responding to the questions. To me, that showed, like, well, why are you getting so moved by mm-hmm. it? I mean, if you don't have any conscience or guilt, why are you getting so moved by it? Why are you slamming your glasses down? Why are you shrugging your shoulders? Why are you scrunching up your face? What's going on in there? You know, so that really is, I really question his body language. Mm-hmm. Right away, I wrote him off. Once he started acting in that manner, nothing he said made any difference to me because it was all full of aggression, and I could just imagine when he came on scene how aggressive he was with Daryl. I could just imagine. No matter what they said, it was mm-hmm. apparent the way he acted just in that courtroom, how he acts when people aren't watching, I'm sure, is far severe.
Right.
So.
Wow.
And so that was one ideal. And then we had the famous Doyle. Oh, he's a lead FBI agent. He's on scene immediately.
The bomb expert, right?
Yeah, he's the supposed bomb expert. Of course, he says he's not an expert of anything. Mm-hmm. He won't even claim that title, although he's adorned with it. He's on scene right away, influencing everyone, and they're all like puppy dogs following his every word. And he never gets his deposition in the mail. He's got 12 years to get it, but somehow he never gets it. And we find out in court, he's actually had two depositions, and they've got copies of both depositions, but he has neither. And he not only counters both depositions, but he counters himself. You know, so it's really ironic. I mean, it seemed like, you know, it wasn't important to them. That's why when who said, I think it was one of the Oakland PD said, "This is devastating at the end of my career that this would happen." Well, if it was so devastating, I mean, why didn't you brush up a bit and get more prepared for this trial? And I just think they all needed acting coaches. They were suffering severely. I mean, the government has all this money. They should have prepped them better. They were a wreck as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I used to be impressed with that title. I mean, all I've ever seen as far as FBI, I'll say the most current would be the movie with Richard, what's his name, the Latin Italian actor, Meet the Parents, Robert De Niro. Right. He's an FBI agent, and that's, you know, that's all I've ever seen of FBI. It's just kind of impressive, you know. They're cutting edge. They can speak in foreign languages. They're mm-hmm. you know, they're all this and that. So you think you'd be really swooned on the, you know, watching them, but they're so bland. I mean, I wasn't impressed in that respect. I thought I was going to really be intrigued with Enelik, and that wasn't the case at all.
Wow.
So. And what about for the plaintiffs? What impressed you there?
Well,
what was the most effective arguments made? You know.
Well, I mean, as far as the argument, you know, it seemed as if you have to understand the atmosphere of the trial. The trial was about. The FBI in Oakland giving an account for their actions. But what the FBI in Oakland police representatives, attorneys did is they made it a case of our Earth first guilty. They tried to sidetrack you and smokescreen you. But see, we knew why we were there, and they were trying to throw in smokescreens and make it something that it wasn't. The U.S. District Attorney said it wasn't that. Long time ago, he threw out all charges. But yet, that's all they kept reinventing. They kept bringing in these. All they had was, I think, five flyers. That was their evidence. Some flyers somebody made up, and that was their evidence. They had nothing. They had nothing on these people. So it was more. You say, what was their turning point? Their turning point was the stuff we weren't able to buy from the other people. These people didn't have arrest records. They hadn't done nothing too atrocious in their background that would make me think they'd take this leap. Hanging a banner on the bridge that says save the planet. The planet needs saving, for God's sake. We're in a total disarray. I mean, that doesn't make me quiver in bed. I'm sorry. I couldn't get with them.
Right.
It's just honestly, they didn't have to say anything. It was just too far. It was like some type of far-fetched fairy tale. It was beyond believable.
So do you think the arrogance and the incompetence of the FBI and the police actually doomed them in some way?
Oh, not so much doomed them. They could have been nice guys, for
right,
God's sake.
Right.
It was just that...
No evidence.
There was no evidence.
Right.
There was nothing. And there was nothing in their record. There was nothing in their history. There was nothing there that made them these people. Yes, they were people that could have been targeted very easily mm-hmm. and by many different people, I presume, but no, they weren't on a suicide mission. It didn't make sense to me. They were getting ready to really embark on something beautiful and something that they were pouring their whole heart and soul in, and the event wasn't even there yet, so why would they sabotage it? It didn't make sense. It didn't make sense, and things have to make sense. I can't, just because you're a police officer, FBI, I'm not going to go follow a fairy tale with you. I'm sorry.
Right.
It's got to make sense.
For those of you just tuning in, we're very, very pleased to have Mary Nunn, one of the jurors from the Barry versus the FBI in Oakland police lawsuit that just was settled more or less in June of this year. And we've been talking about the case and the deliberations, and let's talk about a little bit about the verdict that was handed down. And, you know, we were wondering, why did the jury hang on the wrongful arrest of Darryl Cherney?
Well, we had one individual that she willingly admitted that she never thought that either of them were carrying the bomb. She wanted that to be very clear. But she felt that given what Darryl had in his van, although...
Which was what?
Which was, I guess, a road spiking kit, or one may surmise as to, you know, some rebar, which he said he was going to hold papers down with. But she thought that was enough to lead them to at least go and do the search warrant and justify that, you know, in the arrest, rather. And
she was the only juror that thought that?
Yeah, and we couldn't move her on
mm-hmm.
it.
Well.
And so we had to have a unanimous verdict, and that's why it went down that way. Actually, it was kind of ironic because you know, we did do some compromising with her throughout the deal, and she had told us initially she would give us that, but in the end she took it back, and she had given up. We decided to give conspiracy up for that, but because she did that, and I didn't expect it. I think I was just a little bit too intimidated to stand on it, for fear she may go back on other things. And we had so much, I just let it go.
Mm-hmm. Was, you know, I understand.
Oh, we let it go.
You all let it go.
I don't have that much power.
So, yeah. So I understand that the jury was hung on another count also up until the last day of deliberations.
That's ironic, yeah.
Yeah, so what was that? Was that count?
Well, we kept trying to get clearance throughout it all. I don't know if, well, a lot of people know. We kept sending notes to the judge, and we wanted clearance. We asked for the First and Fourth Amendment, which we were not granted. Because, you know, unbeknownst to most, we probably went over it in high school, but we don't remember it verbatim.
They wouldn't give you copies of the First and Fourth.
I think that was one of the most significant surprising
Whoa.
Things.
Well, that's interesting. She read it to you, right?
Really quick.
She read it to you quickly. So this is something I learned. So our side should have introduced that as evidence.
I heard the FBI wouldn't allow it, right. actually. But
that's
but they
incredible.
Fought not to have that in because they didn't want us to know what it was in detail. And so, you know, we kind of went on, you know.
Who remembers what the First and Fourth Amendment did?
Yeah, and, you know... We really went by her ruling, you know, really. And we went over and over it, her ruling, and we're like, we would say to ourselves, boy, if they had a chance to rewrite this again, I bet they would because, you know, they're making it hard. The way that she versed things, it was almost the way she versed things to the point where you forget everything that has been presented. It constricted you. Mm-hmm. And it really tied us. But we got out of that, you know, that kind of that tight coat, and we were able to do our job, but it was very constrictive, the way that she gave us direction.
Yeah, you guys kind of worked out a Houdini thing in the end, because the directions did really, like, totally it tie really, you up and dropped you into the ocean, and that's why it took 3 weeks to break loose and rise
But getting back on that, what that was we had one of our, one of the 43 rulings, one of them, we kept asking her, if we find some defendants not guilty and some guilty,
right, liable,
is that okay? And can we find? We were trying to get clearance how we could rule within this maneuver, and then we said, can we find someone undecided? Can we be hung on a person?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like being hung on that, but saying no to maybe two, but being undecided about one,
right?
And saying yes to the ordeal, but undecided if he were guilty or not. Because we didn't want to say no, and we didn't want to say yes, but we wanted to leave it undecided. It should have been hung.
Right.
But that's what we delivered to her that day. And we were really ready to deliver that day. Mm-hmm. We wanted to give our verdict. We were prepared.
And she sent you back.
She sent us back.
And what was that one that you were asking about? Was that on... Do you remember what...
Yeah, I do remember what it was. It was... It was the Daryl's one.
The Daryl thing.
Yeah.
Right. There wasn't a second one that you also were hung up on.
No. The conspiracy. It was only conspiracy and Daryl's.
Oh, okay.
That was it. There were two.
Those were the two.
And then we did absolutely, we did no to the second search warrant, because the reason why is because, the time.
The second search warrant was Judy's.
Judy and Daryl's
the second search on Judy's home. Yeah, why did you decide against that?
Even though it was made with the same paper,
and
it was redone with the same paper, and the paper was not valid, the people in the room said they waited more time. So regardless if it was filled with lies, they said they waited more time, so it gave it more credence. And although I didn't care for it, majority was against me, so it was just one of that give and take things.
Right.
So
right.
Actually, it's three issues. So
yeah.
But the thing was, Daryl. So what we ended up doing instead of making some walk and some undecided. We just made the whole thing undecided,
right.
Which was actually even worse because it gave it fuel to be retried, mm-hmm. possibly.
Right.
So if she had let it go, as it were, then probably she'd have more closure in that. Some people could be walking and not having mm-hmm. to come back to court.
That's
but
right.
She made it worse, so she might have, but she didn't like that untidiness about that ruling. She wanted it cut or dry. And we kept sending notes.
Her being the woman, the juror.
The judge
right.
didn't
okay.
like the way right. that it was. A lot of the problems that we have was one juror, and one juror just wasn't coming on. I mean, she came on board on many, many things, but she wasn't coming on board on some things. She wasn't. She really wanted to believe in her police officers and her mm-hmm. FBI and.
Yes. It's a hard leap to make.
I mean, she saw everything that was blatant, and she ruled accordingly, obviously, but she just didn't want to fry him at the stake. She didn't want to go with the conspiracy. She wanted to okay the second search warrant. So that it wasn't so bad, you know.
Right.
But it all was bad anyway. I mean, even with those elements, letting them walk on those elements, it doesn't mean that they weren't guilty on them. They were guilty on them. But you couldn't get everything. To get 10 people to agree on 43 rulings attached to 7 different people.
Say that again for people that don't get that. 10 people had to agree on
43 issues unanimously, and each of those issues were attached to 7 different individuals. So it was grueling. I mean, it was difficult. I mean, there's 43 issues you have to agree upon unanimously. I mean,
for each person?
Yeah, I mean, if you take someone to an ice cream parlor, they're not all going to agree on the same ice cream. I mean, could you imagine something as detrimental as this? It was rough, and there were times you wanted to pull your hair out, and there were times you were warmer than heck within your heart because things were going well, and it was up and down. It was an emotional roller coaster. It was rough in there at times. And even though we were very, very civil, it was really ironic. We were always civil, even if you got a little. Subtly offensive, but not really. Someone would pull your coat on it and say, "You know, that's not called for." And then you'd say, "Okay," and that was it. You didn't make much more of it because we never forgot that it wasn't about us against one another. It was about giving a good verdict and giving a righteous verdict. It wasn't about me and that juror. You know, it wasn't about that. But although opinions did play key, and upbringing did play key, and
let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the dynamics on the jury. So the jury was made up of 8 women, 2 men, and one of the men was an Afro-American guy, and one of the women was Afro-American. It was like many more women on the jury. So did the women run the show, or, you know, how did that play out?
Well,
and also let's talk a little bit about the class dynamics after that.
First thing that we did is we took a vote as how we felt overall. That's the first thing we did. And the vote was even. I was like, oh. So it was a little scary. This is the first day, mind you. Mm-hmm. No one's discussed a thing.
Right.
We just go in the room, and we thought that'd be a great way to start. Mm-hmm. Let's get a feel of the room and see how everybody's sitting right now. And we took a vote, and it was even.
Whoa.
And I was like, wow, where can we go with this? And Jerry stood up, and he grabbed some chalk, and he says, the power of group decision. I said, okay, let's check this out. Let's play along. And through it all, they would say, let the process take place. Let it flow. See where it goes. Because I was really like, oh, you know, I was getting impatient. I was like, come on already. You know, I wanted it to flow a little mm-hmm. faster. Mm-hmm. But they weren't willing to. They were really, they went through everything with a fine-tooth mm-hmm. comb. We would address one issue all day. We would go round and round like a round table, and we would address it, and we would rebuttal it, and we would just talk it till you couldn't talk it down anymore. We would just deplete the whole matter, and there was never, I've never seen a lot of juries, but I swear to you, we were never more fair than I've seen in any setting. I mean, it was fair, and we respected one's view, and we appreciated it. We tried diligently to show them lights on certain things, and they tried diligently to show us maybe how they felt on something. But in the end, through note-keeping, through evidence book, we were able to bring them on board.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, some people weren't taking notes. Some people were just kind of loafing in there, eyes drifting, you know, maybe fading out a bit. It was a long day. I mean, sometimes they went over things, rehashed things, 5 or 6 times. People probably escaped a bit mentally. I was trying not hard to to do that. I thought this was important stuff. It was pertinent that I write down everything. And I knew it would be useful later. There was a reason to have this pad and paper and pencil. And I was there to do a duty, and I wanted to do it well. And I wanted to see justice prevail. Yeah. I took it very serious. It was a big, big deal to me. Very much so. Yeah. And so there was no way. So a lot of times they had nothing to consult because they had written nothing. They weren't paying attention. It's called selective hearing. Yeah. And it's sad. But they were a little blasé about it. And that's why there was confusion initially. Mm-hmm. But once we showed them in the evidence book, which was beautifully orchestrated, it was like reading a book, the way it was put together. And some people thought, you know, I kept saying, this is the plainest book they brought to the table. And some people said, no, no, they just didn't want to share stuff. That's why that's so thick. They just didn't want to duplicate it. I said, no, that's not it. This is all they brought. See these obscure flyers? There's only five or seven. That's all they brought. That's all they have is evidence. They have nothing on these people. This is what the plaintiffs brought. And they would not believe me. Mm-hmm. Even the president of the bank said, no, no, they just didn't want to duplicate. So they weren't hip on court procedures or what's presented or how it's presented. So you had a lot of people that were very green. And when I said they took this case on pro bono, they thought that means you get paid later. They didn't get it. They didn't get it. And I told them, look, there's no interest here with money. The guy drives... I saw his car, not because I was following, because we parked in the same parking lot. one of the lawyers, he drove a Chevy... The cheapest Chevy, smallest economical car you could buy. You could probably pick one up for 4,000 tops off the lot, brand new. I mean, they're not in. He totally was into this for principle, and they just didn't get it. They didn't get it, and they didn't get the terms. And they didn't, and I kept swearing by it. I said, "Let's present a note to the judge. She'll say so." And they would just, "If you want to, you know." It was a rough place. It was an odd place, but I don't know. It's, what are you going to do when you're dealing with that? You know, so we did bring up the pages of the book. Mm-hmm. We did go through it. I saw so many times that these people tried to present this case and how many times it was shot and how many angles they tried to take to get it in there. You know, suing Doyle and suing a few here, it wasn't working. They needed to come with something that would stick, and they finally found a way. Yeah. And it was great that they didn't. I'm glad they didn't give up and they pursued it. And I hope other people that are scared and stagnated from moving forward, maybe this will give them the courage to face them and bring it in the forefront. I don't know if you know this, but during this trial in my neighborhood, there's nothing much that goes on in my neighborhood. It's a little town, East County, and some teenage boys had some exchanges, and somebody said they had a gun. Well, pretty soon the Oakley police was in town around my neighborhood, and they're never there, never. And the whole year I've been there, I've never seen them. So I went out front to see what the commotion was about. They had everybody that had taken their nightly stroll in handcuffs in the back seats of their cars. They had about six cars. And one lady, this is why I was upset, she had just lost her son 2 weeks prior to sickle cell. And so she's still in mourning, and she's got these two little toddlers, well, not toddlers, they're 8 and 9, and they're riding their bikes, and she always gathers them up at dusk, because it's a safe neighborhood, we all... You know, it's, you don't worry so much about kid snatching, although who knows where, but I'm just saying. And she's out there trying to round up her babies. She's in the back seat of police car handcuffs. But that's not the biggest aspect of it all. The boy who lives directly across from me comes home on weekend from college. He came out after lifting weights and stands out on his stoop, and the cops draw guns and say, "Get on the ground!" And he says, "I just got stepped out of my house. Get on the ground!" They grab him and throw him headfirst into the gutter, scraping up his head, and throw him in the backseat of the car handcuffed. His father's livid. He says, "I want your badge number," because not a single cop had a badge on with a name. And
no way.
I swear to you. And he was so upset in wanting this from this officer. An officer says, continue our investigation. Don't interrupt us. And I said, "I'll get the badge number. Don't worry. Just calm down." So I went up to him. I said, "Sir, could I have your badge number, please?" He says, "If one more of you say one more thing, you're all going to jail." And so I just walked away very slowly, and I said, "Boy, the Oakley Police Department really needs to be investigated." And then the older cop with the gray hair just snarled at me. But, you know, this is the kind of thing I see all the time. But it goes on all the time. I mean, they're just over zealous. They're just, they're quick to mm-hmm. act. The guns are out. They could go off anything. God forbid if I would have been walking my Rottweiler that night. He'd probably be dead.
Were these white people or black people? Or
the boy that came out on the curb, the one that was handled very aggressively, he was black.
He was black.
Of
and
course.
The woman who was handcuffed?
Of course.
And the woman who was handcuffed in the back of
black,
the car?
Black.
Right, right, of course. Okay.
And a Christian, devout Christian, mind you.
No. But, and,
I mean, I'm just saying, it didn't fit. The most sweetest, loving woman in the world. She's right. Married to a man from Panama. I mean, they're a beautiful, gorgeous family.
Maria Dee was the Afro-American attorney for the Oakland Police.
Yeah.
And what did the jury think of her argument that the use of the name Mississippi Summer and the Redwoods or in any way drawing parallels with the nation's most well-known civil rights struggle was demeaning to black people?
To me, she was a joke. I'm sorry. To me, she was a joke. I grew up in an all-black neighborhood. I know a lot of professional black women, many so, one being my mother-in-law, whom was the president of an electronics firm in Foster City, bought and sold 5 homes, mm-hmm. all by herself, coming to town 50-some years ago with $5 in her pocket and 4 boys in tow, and she levitated to this level. Mm-hmm. No one can fill her shoes, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, she'd come up this fake smile, mm-hmm. and her whole purpose was, it wasn't the Oakland PD, now was it? It was the FBI agent that was there, now wasn't it? My people didn't have anything to do with that. Isn't that correct? And once they would say, maybe. Okay, thank you. And she'd sit down. And that was it. Her only thing was to exonerate the Oakland PD. Never giving rhyme or reason for anything, just making sure they weren't put in the pot. And that didn't excuse them from the pot because she got one of her people to say that they weren't. It didn't mean anything to me. All those people were paid, the doctor. They had this doctor there that was making $500 an hour to testify. I mean, come on. I would have got up there and said whatever they wanted for $500.
$5,000, right?
I think we got $5,000. I'm sorry. More than I can conceive of. But it was $500 even is something.
Right.
But what a joke. I mean, come on. The guy was paid $5,000 an hour, and you're supposed to trust what he says? Come on.
$5,000?
Well, maybe it was $500 an hour. Who knows?
I don't know. I mean, come on. Does that make you want to believe in this guy? And he was a real kind of you could just tell a real, make your skin crawl kind of guy. His only motivator in life is money. So what does that say about his character?
Right, and Judy's doctor came and testified for nothing because he took care of her and he cared.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the only person I did trust was her doctor because he was firsthand and he was ethical and he seemed like his only intention was to tell the truth, and most doctors are that way. That doctor, I would never want to have anything to do with him. Any doctor that would, doesn't he make enough money over there on the South Bay where he has to come over and do such tactics? I mean, they already rob you over there anyway because it's too pricey to live. So I can't understand it. But no, I only went by what her doctor said and what her injuries projected. And her injuries said it all as to where the bomb was for me. I mean, that was it. Once I heard what had happened to her, nobody's going to set themselves up like that to harm themselves in that way. They were both educated people. They weren't dummies. She's not going to do something like that. It was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous concept. And where they ever thought anyone was going to buy. See, they never thought they'd be in this setting. That's why they did this this chaos. They never thought it would ever get to this place in time. If they had, they probably would never have done the things they did, because if they had ever known it would be presented in front of a jury, especially in 2002, mm-hmm. we're just too far ahead of that. We're not buying that. We've seen too much corruption on the TV, too many beatings, too much misconduct, too much corporate scoundrels running blatant. Our president has a crook watching the crooks, the guy from Providian. I mean, what kind of joke is that? I mean, they're just running rampant in the world. We just tolerated them. We had to sit there and go through the process. It was all very insultive and all very obnoxious, but you had to sit there and be polite and tolerate them. You had to go through the process. It was difficult, but we did it.
Now some of the jury, in fact, probably the majority of the jury, never would have imagined that law enforcement would behave in this way. Is that right?
They didn't think they would risk their jobs.
Risk their jobs.
But the thing is, their jobs are never in jeopardy. So they can act this way and do whatever they want under the sun with God watching, and they're never held in account. The only time they're ever held in account on rare occasions when someone has a video camera in hand. That's the only time. Mm-hmm. But Do you know how many times there's no video camera around? Those are rare occasions. So it happens every day.
Right.
Every
day. You watched it happen in your neighborhood.
That's not the only place I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the most recent place I've seen it happen.
Right.
So I'm having calls come in on the phone. Can I, like, run them by and you can choose?
Run by questions that they're asking?
A couple of questions.
You choose the questions. You think there's some good questions out there? Throw them one out.
Someone wanted to know why Chennault was treated differently than the other defendants.
In what facet?
It's the caller seemed to think that Chennault was more protected than the rest, and I don't really have a frame of reference for that. So
I don't believe so. I think Chennault was held accountable for the things in which he did, such as the search warrant. He got fined profusely. As far as the search itself, because he was on the FBI helicopter, he was found guilty. I think he got handled appropriately.
He wasn't a supervisor. That might be
right.
Part of it.
Yeah, that's why. I think for uh-huh. what his you yeah. see what you understand is he was new on the force. He was trying to win brownie points. He was trying to fit in with the white boys, and this is how he went about doing it. And it's sad, but that's what he did. I mean, people do things to earn brownie points and to fit in. He was new in homicide. He was with the drug force for a while, uh-huh. and I could imagine the stuff he left behind there. I could imagine. You know, I don't want to even fathom the thought, but the guy was, as much as we could do with the conservative jury that we had, mm-hmm. we got what we could on him as much as possible. We worked with what we had. We did not protect him okay. by any means. He thinks that he does. He thinks he's not defined by how we ruled. He says, all my years of service is not defined by this act. Well, in actuality, it is, because it shows America that you lie on search warrants, and you find that's quite commonplace, and there's nothing wrong with it, and why should it be questioned? So, yeah, it does show that something's wrong with your character, very much so.
Okay, and one that was of particular concern to our listeners was the Spike a Tree for Jesus song. How did that affect the jury?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't think that anyone in my jury was really religiously moved one way or another. If they did, they didn't attest to it. I didn't see anything like that. Nobody really said too much about it.
It wasn't discussed during deliberations.
No,
it
wasn't even.
It
wasn't even brought. It wasn't even part of anything. We didn't format anything behind that song. It wasn't even brought up, not once. If you want to know how I funneled it, I thought it was just. What it did is it characterized the crucifixion of character that they did on those two. If the only relation I made with the song, as far as crucifying Jesus, I mean, they crucified these two people's whole character. They smeared them. So that's the only crucification I could tie in with the song. I'm probably the most religious one on the jury, meaning that I have a very intimate relationship with my Father in heaven. I love him profusely. There's not anything I don't do that I don't interact with him first and foremost, be it big or small. I don't have anyone else. I'm an orphan, per se. I really am. So when I have problems in life, I go to him. I mean, and then I hope he's listening, you know, and I hope he directs me. But the thing is, I know who killed Jesus. You know, the Romans killed Jesus. I mean, it's like ridiculous. I mean, we're going to all be misled? I mean, come on. We're grown-up people. We know our history. So it's the song's
so
not going to...
people got that it was a satire.
Of course.
Okay. So do you think the jury was afraid to find the FBI and Oakland Police liable? Was
I think so, yeah. I think they thought there would be some repercussion. That's why they all diverted. That's why they all hid. That's why they won't speak out. They're scared. I'm not a scary type. Maybe that's going to be my downfall, but I'm not a scary type. And it doesn't mean that I haven't had things happen within my life that would make you scared. I've been in many, many trying situations, but it made me stronger. I get stronger from events. I don't weaken. So the more I'm subjected to, the more stronger I get it. So it's more, once you get something, go through something and overcome it, you become stronger, you don't become weaker. So, but for them, they diverted, they were reclusive, they wanted to do that. They were discussing they would do that anyway, way before. But they also said they wanted, whatever they did on that verdict form was going to be something that would make their kids proud and that they could sleep at night mm-hmm. and that they could sit with. So. Even though I'm very boisterous, there's no way I ruled for everyone in that room. I mean, everyone did it of their own mind. I'm just the only one that's willing to speak out because, well, you know, if something happens to me, then you all know who did it, because I don't have any enemies, I'll tell you right now. I have none. None that I know of. So if something happens to me, they're directly responsible. I tell you that 100%. So
right on. So speaking out, 80% of the total damage award was for First Amendment violations. How did the defendants violate the First Amendment rights? And, you know, and during the trial, what aspects of that moved you the most?
Okay, well, I guess the aspect of they put them under arrest, the TV smears.
Let's describe that for listeners who, okay. A lot of listeners here just have radio.
Okay. First of all, our orders from Claudia Wilkins was not to watch any TV, not to read any books, not any news articles. She said we could watch news and read the current affairs, but if you saw something that addressed the trial, turn the page or turn the channel. And we all followed suit. So we didn't go out of our way to research anything. We all stayed stringent on that ruling. We didn't. I think we wanted this case so much, and we wanted to do some good in this case so much. We didn't want to do anything to put us in the subjection of losing it. Mm-hmm. So we followed all the rules. And as we were following the rules of the case...
So there was a TV... The TV smear happened right after the bombing.
Right.
You didn't see any of that.
No. So see, I'm learning... As I'm going along, because I don't remember this case.
Did they introduce that video footage
as
evidence?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
And that video footage was the first I ever saw of any newscast. I was wanting something. I was wanting to see some old newspapers of back then, but I had no access to anything. I'm not online. I don't have any access. And I have a computer, but I'm not online. And it's unfortunate, but I'm not. And... So, I mean, I wouldn't have dared anyway, looked up during it, but I'm just saying, even after the fact, I had no access. So it's, I totally went in there, you know, not knowing anything. And when they started rolling it, you know, the footage, and also they presented the case and they attested the fact what had happened to these people through their smearing and through Sims' nightly addresses on the TV screen, talking about these are the only subjects, these are the only ones we're focusing on, there are no others, but we're open, but these are the guys, and these are the bombers, these are who we have, we're open to more information, but we're focused, you know, we're going to QAnon on these two, and they smeared them, and the news went cross-country, and people no longer wanted to be associated with these folks. I mean, maybe some, maybe they're stringent friends, but some were like, do we really want this? This looks bad. You know, do we, you know, we've got this prop out, they lost the proposition.
Right,
they,
Prop 130.
Yeah, I mean, not by much, but they did lose it. They probably would have gained more had this not happened. People were scared to attach themselves to them. When they went out, when they finally settled back into their homes, their kids were taunted. They were taunted. They walked in fear. They were limited. I mean, somebody said their voice was stronger. Like, heck, it was stronger. How could it be stronger once you know someone blew up half of your body? What's left to say they won't do it again? They weren't caught. Gives them more incentive to do it again. Normally, you keep on going till you're caught. That's how most thieves and crimes persist. They keep doing it till they're caught. And so I think they were in danger from that point on, and they were very leery, very leery. So, yeah, they stifled them. Yeah, they quieted their voice. So, absolutely, they were in violation of First Amendment. They lived in fear from that time on, and probably till this day. I'm in fear a bit. Honestly, I'm in fear a bit. But, you know, I can't let it stagnate me. I can't let it stagnate me. Yeah.
It's a terrible thing that when the government and the forces that are supposed to support us, when we're afraid of them and we're righteously afraid of them, that just seems to me to be... It seems to me that there's so many people all over the country, and if you ask them, they'll tell you they're afraid. They're afraid of their own government. They're afraid of their police. They're afraid of... You know,
look what they did to Ernest Hemingway.
Right.
I mean, come on. I mean, throughout history, they have the power to harm people, big people. They brought down big people, let alone little people. Even my husband said, "Why don't you watch it, honey? Before you end up in the bay, you said enough. You done your part. You did your gig. Please stop." And I didn't, you know, I didn't tell him about my visit here today because, I don't want to worry him. You know. I don't want to worry my husband unnecessarily because he's got enough to contend with, bills and kids and everything else, and I want him to focus on that. This is something for me. This is between me and my heart. That's why I do it. It's not about my husband. My husband wasn't in the room. He can't relate to what I feel or what moves me, but I feel a need to. to talk about this because mm-hmm. it was such a dishonorment to these folks, and they do these things. And America needs to wake up and be aware.
Well, they're asking for money right now to do more of it.
Yeah. Of course they are. And you know, that's kind of a joke, you know, because the setting I work in, you know.
Where do you work?
I work for American Airlines.
Ooh.
And I work in passenger service. I'm a ticket agent, and we're dealing with the baggage and the x-rays and the targeting and what have you. And it's really funny. Well, just to give you a little insight how cutting edge our FBI are, this is just how intelligent they so very are. Our security process is designated to the T of what those guys did that day. If you buy, well, I can't even say. I'm not going to say what it is because that would be.
Right, we can guess.
Don't tell us.
But it's to the T. Nothing less, nothing more, but exactly to the T. They don't even have a few steps ahead. So they're not cutting edge. They're not street savvy. The thing that happened at LL Airlines should tell you that. That should have never happened. Uh-huh. See, if they were really protecting us, that ticket agent wouldn't be shot. You understand me?
Yes.
So that, see, because the security point should start out there on that roadway as you proceed to the airport, not when you're at the security point yards away from the plane. If there's seven guys with machine guns and there's one cop, they're already got you. You understand me?
Yes.
So that one cop's not going to do anything but get shot and feel his family's going to mourn. They're not prepared. We got one cop protecting Oakland Airport. That's it. And he's sitting. Oh, three, excuse me. Three. Three for how many people? How many thousands and thousands of people? How many airplanes? We've got three cops, and they're sitting down, and they're in conversation. Go ahead, check them out. Observe them. They're not on guard. The National Guard's gone, and they didn't have any rounds in their guns anyway. I know, because some of our guys are military, and they told me as such. And all the pilots say, thank God they left the axe in the cockpit, because that's our last line of defense. It's not the cops, and it's not the FBI. They're not protecting us. You better know how to drop and roll. That's the only protection you have. Honestly.
Yeah.
They're only into their income and retiring. That's it. They're big, savvy incomes and retiring and getting into as least harm as possible so that they can retire. We all want to retire. That's our heyday, right? We do what we have to do now so we can do what we want to do then. So this is what they do. This is what they do best. So do you see them finding any of the missing babies? Even one?
Heck no.
Mm-hmm. Not one. Do they take out the FBI helicopter to find the missing baby, which is so pertinent within the first hour? Do they do that? Hell no, they don't do it. But they go and they smear two innocent hippies up north. I mean, what's that about? Because you know why? Because it's harmless. They won't get hurt.
I got a good question over the phone.
Yeah.
Caller wants to know, how did you mask your wonderfulness to get chosen for the jury?
tips
for getting chosen.
I don't know that I did. What I did do is they asked me, "Will you, by Almighty God, be fair?" And I said, "By my Almighty God, I will." And I meant that. And when I left that courtroom, what did I do? I got into prayer in the car on the way home. I got into prayer and I said, "Dear Lord Father, open my mind to see the truth in this. If I don't understand something, give me the insight to see it. Let me see the truth in this, please." Even when I would deliberate and I didn't know what to say, I would ask God, give me the insight to make sense to my fellow jurors, to talk so that I'm clear, so that you can understand me. And I consorted with him in all of it because I'm new at this. I was lost. I didn't know what I was about to embark upon. And I needed his guidance and I needed his insight. Who better to consult than he, huh? And so what happened is a direct result of what he wanted to happen. Believe you me, God don't get behind bad. Okay, and what
that's right. God only get behind good.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that's what prevailed, and we took our time. You're talking 2 months of trial and another 3 weeks of deliberation. We took our time. We had flyers all over the room. We had columns. We'd have Chenault's name. We'd have Doyle's name. We'd have Senna's name. We'd have all the key players, Reich's, all of them, and we went down a list of how they contributed to the dysfunction of that day, and we went through it all. We didn't talk money till the very last week. Does that sound like someone who rushed or tried to burn these guys at the stake?
Right.
The last week. Because it was more important to find out what they did and how much they did than burn them at the stake. We wanted to be sure. You know what I mean? We didn't want to rush. We wanted to be sure, and that's exactly what we did. We took our time. It was painful at times because we were all convinced they were guilty, so let's start talking the money. This is what this is about. And
it was hard.
It was hard to get those wheels rolling, but eventually they did. Okay. And when that's why I guess once the money came out on the board and it was settled, I was so exhausted because it was such a fight to get it out on the board.
Right.
That I didn't get involved with the where it went.
Hey, Mary.
Yeah.
Let's end this interview with talking a little bit about Judy Barry and what your impressions of her was. And she really was the force and the spirit that mm-hmm. took this case where it did go.
Well, what I thought of her was, you know, me not knowing a lot about what she was involved in initially, but coming to know it. And, you know, I think we all appreciate this beauty that I'm surrounded by here today. We all want it, but we're not going to take time out of our day or our incomes to make it happen. Very few are. Everybody's chasing the almighty dollar. We're all motivated by money. Not all of us. Remote few aren't. Unique individuals aren't. Someone that's that driven and that dedicated to do what she did for that length of time, it really says something about someone. And she was very eloquent. I had the privilege of someone mailing me some tapes. One of the editors of a newspaper, he said, give me an interview. And I said, you know, I'd really like to see some tapes on Judy, and if you have anything, because, you know, I want to get acquainted with her. The judge says we can go online and we can research and we do all these things. We can talk to media. So, hey, if you got something, I really would appreciate it. So Nicholas sent me something, and I've been watching it quite a bit. I rewind it, I watch it, and I've got acquainted with her through those videos to some respect. I couldn't absolutely know her in total, but it gave me some insight as to who she was. And not only that, even in court, her deposition was very moving. I didn't know, though, it didn't come out till after court. Did they hush him on that as well, that she was that close to death? They didn't let on, I don't believe, but it wasn't prominent in my mind that she was a month to her death. To me, I'd be too depressed to want to talk about it. But she was even moved then. She didn't let her impeding death get in the way of her giving her address. She still wanted justice prevail, even if she wasn't here. So that in itself was gorgeous. I mean, come on. I mean, I would be depressed. I'd be in a shell. I wouldn't want to talk to anyone because I'm going to die soon, you see? And that's something I wouldn't want to do, probably, huh? And I mean, I love life as it is. So for her to be able to do that. And another thing I didn't know is, I read later that her ashes were there in a burlap sack with beautiful roses, or flowers, rather. And I saw the box, and I thought it was pretty. I didn't. They always had something on the table, like flowers, or something that was, you know, fruitful. And so I didn't think there was ashes, and I read later, and that was very nice as well, that they brought her for the day of the verdict. And that it was a pleasant verdict to her ears.
This interview was recorded live on KMUD's Women on Wednesday and was produced by Bear.